2FM
with Green Farm. Being up to 90 isn't real. The protein in our range is. Get real.
Thanks to Jenny Green for getting the week off to a super start. It's Monday, the 24th of January, and this is Game On. Coming up today, Rory Best and Shane Byrne on Irish hopes for the rest of the Champions Cup as the round of 16 awaits.
It's going to be very unique, the first time in the Champions Cup, that it's going to be literally on points across two legs. So if you win or lose the first one by X amount of points, you've got to better that the second time around. So it's going to be very unique for all 16 teams, and really looking forward to it.
In American football, Jeff Shepherd told us Buffalo and Kansas City was going to be the game of the year, and boy, was he right.
It's going to be 49 yards is what it is. 49 yards to send it to overtime. Harrison Butker. So are hundreds of thousands around the planet. The kick is good! It's going overtime!
Absolute scenes. Plus, Alan Colley and Stephen Kelly are with us as the Premier League pauses for a winter break. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Now, welcome along. I'm delighted to be joined in studio by RTÉ's Shane Dawson. It was a pretty spectacular weekend of sport all round. I got to a few games myself, went down to the Auburn Cup final between Dublin and Laois, and stopped on the way back home at the National Cup final between Neptune and Tralee Warriors. An absolutely brilliant evening of entertainment, full of fans, almost a packed house, and everybody filled with the joy as well. Truly Warriors more so than Neptune, but they definitely travelled in force, and it was brilliant to see so many fans back in indoor settings and just enjoying themselves. And I also then got to the All-Ireland semi-final, junior semi-final women's game between Carrickmacross and St Jude's, with St Jude's coming out on top there. So lots of sporting action this weekend. If anybody was anywhere nice or exciting or interesting, do text us on 51552 and let us know where you were and what you got up to, as restrictions have pretty much now all been lifted. Shane Dawson, anything exciting for you for the weekend?
Well, unfortunately, due to the nature of my work and occupational hazard, meant I was stuck in an RTÉ newsroom watching the sport on multiple TVs as opposed to being there. So I'm quite jealous of your weekend, to be honest with you, Marie. I'm going to have to wait a little bit longer. I'm hoping to make it to Croke Park next Saturday, and even then a couple of weeks later on, I'm really looking forward to the return of the League of Ireland and capacity stadiums once again. But for me, my sporting highlight, I suppose, TJ Reid, phenomenal. Just, I, for anyone who didn't see it, I don't know if you've been living under a rock, but dragging Ballyhale Shamrocks over the line against St Thomas's at the weekend to secure a place in the All-Ireland Senior Club Hurling Championship final, last puck of the game.
So there were 2 points down.
Yeah, so there were, so basically, St Thomas's controlled the match for the majority, really, and they pulled away. I think Conor Cooney, you know, was excellent from set pieces and indeed from play. So Conor Cooney put them 4 points ahead. And then in the last 5 minutes, Colin Fenley was dragged down for a penalty. TJ Reid stepped up, scores the penalty. So that draws them level. Then Conor Cooney knocks over two more frees to put St Thomas's ahead, and you're thinking that's 1 foot in the final, job done. And then the angle of the free by TJ Reid out to the right side, and he somehow goes through the whole of St Thomas's defence and the goalkeeper and gets a goal with what was, I think, if to be pedantic, the second last puck of the game, because I think there was a puck out taken before the final whistle was blown. But just phenomenal, just no better man, you know. And that's, it just shows the,
I suppose, so you were watching it, I was watching it as well, so when he stepped up to take that, did you think he's
no,
going to get it?
I don't think anyone, and if anyone's saying, oh, well, like, listen, if anyone can do it,
well,
TJ Reid could
did.
Do it. Yeah, and I know, to be fair, I think he said after in his post-match interview that it was, he just had a chat with the referee, he said, how long's left? And he's like, 20 or 30 seconds, so I need a bit of luck on my side, I'm just going to hit it and go for it. And he went for it, you know. But I suppose if anyone was to say, if anyone could do it, TJ Reid was going to do it. Like, I wasn't expecting that. And especially, okay, they got the penalty and they dragged them back. But then when any team kind of just sees it out with a couple of frees, as like Conor Cooney did, you're thinking, okay, that was their chance. But for TJ to do it, it's just unreal. And, you know, I think he really now has to be always included, if he wasn't already, on when you're talking about your Henry Shefflins, DJ Careys, your Eddie Kerrs, Charlie Carters, whoever you want to name from you know, Kilkenny hurlers, TJ has to be up there. It was just unbelievable, an unbelievable finish, and you know, makes for a great final. I think the dates for the finals were announced today, so Saturday the 12th of February it'll be Ballyhale Shamrocks and against Ballygunner. Ballygunner had a good win against Shlocknil, and then the football final will be later that afternoon at 5 p.m. So yeah, again, not to leave out Ballygunner Shlocknil up in Parnell Park. Great to see crowds back in a wonderful North Dublin venue there as well. They were comfortable winners in the end. Billy O'Keefe, I think, scored 2-3, so he done well. But yeah, no, in terms of sporting highlights, unfortunately I didn't get to a game, so hopefully we can have this chat next week when I was actually can be there as a supporter, as a fan watching live sport, but from watching on from the television screen, unfortunately, as I say, TJ Reid, just unreal.
Yeah, I think there'll be a lot of people nodding in agreement with you there, Shane, because it's going to be really hard to top that. Just phenomenal stuff altogether. And I think it looks like we have seen the end of the water break, so I must mark that down in my diary that the very last time was last weekend. They're going to be scrapped now, it seems.
You were part of history, Marie.
Yeah. I'm never a big fan of them, to be honest. So I was pretty happy now to see them come to an end. I was a bit concerned that the GAA might opt to keep them, but looks like now they're going to go.
Yeah, common sense prevails. I think that was the one. I know we were all getting, myself, yourself and Jane Mangan were here on Friday getting a bit giddy with Micheál Martin's speech, and I was like, will you mention water breaks? This is one of the first things I want to see gone now that COVID's allegedly gone. But yeah, Damien Lawler, our GA reporter, reporting that the CCCC is set to officially recommend the removal of the water breaks early this week, and it could happen actually as soon as tomorrow. So with the Allianz League set to start this weekend, hopefully that's the last we see of water breaks, because I'd be in complete agreement with yourself, Marie, that not for me.
Same. It just feels like a different game, and it just ruins the momentum of many of them. Although I'm sure if you are a manager and your team are losing and you need that break to get reset and get things going again, they've helped many a team get over the line on big occasions. So moving to football, I have to admit, I have kind of switched off from the African Cup of Nations a little bit. I really only tuned in to see Pico Lopez, if I'm being honest, and haven't really been glued to it. But you've been keeping an eye on things.
Absolutely. You were mentioning my enthusiasm for this competition a few days ago, Marie, and it has not waned whatsoever. So yesterday we saw Nigeria, who were favourites to possibly even make it to a final. They were knocked out by Tunisia. 10-man Nigeria, Alex Iwobi was shown a red card in the 66th minute, if memory serves me right. So that was the weekend. Then also, I suppose it's nearly a daily occurrence now, if not weekly occurrence, where I have to mention a goalkeeper, Marie. So before we get on to Comoros and the goalkeeping woes that they're having, if anyone hasn't seen the video that's on social media, so Burkina Faso beat Gabon 7-6 on penalties, and then what does the goalkeeper do to celebrate? He does handstands and flips nearly half the length of the pitch. It's going around on social media. Look it up. It's brilliant. So Burkina Faso and Tunisia are through to the next round. And then earlier today, another exceptional story. The Gambia defeated Guinea 1-0, and this is Gambia's first ever African Cup of Nations. They've had to wait 69 years, because that's when they were even founded as a football nation, and they're true. So it was, you know, the biggest result in their 69-year international footballing history. And just for context, Gambia had to qualify for the qualifiers in order to get to the competition itself. So absolutely amazing stuff for Gambia. So they're true as well. And then later this evening, 7 p.m. kickoff, Comoros and Cameroon. Now, unfortunately, I think this is going to be a foregone conclusion that Cameroon will win, because Comoros will have to play an outfield player in goal. So the situation there is their three goalkeepers are unavailable, two are COVID related, one is out with a shoulder injury. But there has been a bit of uproar, shall we say, because Ali Ahmada will not be able to play this evening, even though he tested negative for COVID this morning. So the situation is that the tournament rules state a player who tests positive for coronavirus must isolate for 5 days before taking another PCR test 48 hours before his side's next match. So Comoros are less than pleased, and considering they were, you know, outsiders going into this one as well, I think they're ranked 132nd, coming up against Cameroon, host nation, I fear it's not going to be pretty. I know I'm always trying to big up the goalkeepers here and toe the union line, but I fear it's going to be a bit difficult, to say the least.
And you're already blaming the goalkeeper before it's even started. Very, very harsh. So do you have a team? Are you supporting someone? Or are you following someone?
I'm a fan of association football, Marie. I'm just a fan of seeing entertaining football, and that's what I hope to see in this African Cup of Nations. And I'm hoping to see some more goalkeeping stories that I can report on.
Well, we're going to have to switch attention away from goalkeepers now and on to managers. And it looks like Watford are going to be looking for a new manager again, their third manager of the season, if reports are correct that they have sacked Claudio Ranieri after just 3 months in charge.
Yeah, well, it doesn't get much more breaking news than this, because Watford have just tweeted from their official account there that the Watford Football Club confirms the departure of head coach Claudio Ranieri. The Hornets board recognises Claudio as a man of great integrity and honour who will always be respected here at Vicarage Road for his efforts in leading the team with dignity. And I suppose, following up on those quotes, Watford don't seem to be a club treating their managers with much dignity, I should say, considering the high turnover. Yeah, I mean, I suppose when you look at the record that he had with Watford, it's somewhat understandable, but 112 days in charge, they're in 19th place, they've lost 11 of his last 14 matches in charge of Vicarage Road, so it's not a great record. But like, listen, I suppose everyone knows that the history behind Watford and the managerial changes and the chop and changing that's going on there. It's, you feel sorry for Claudio Ranieri, considering the, you know, obviously what he'd done with Leicester, and I suppose Chelsea fans will have a bit of a soft spot for him as well for back in the day. But yeah, so it's official now anyway, he is gone. And I know, I'm sure you'll be touching on it a bit later on with Alan Colley and Stephen Kelly, you know, to get their viewpoints on it. But yeah, unfortunate, and just such a quick turnover is a bit ridiculous.
Yeah, the merry-go-round keeps on turning. I'm sure there'll be the usual suspects all lining up to be linked with that job. And let's move on to Bose, though, because it was kind of one of those mixed days for them. Really good news. They've got a new jersey coming out. Bob Marley colours on the front of it again. And then a little bit later on, after we get the announcement and see the lovely pictures of the new jersey, the news is confirmed that Andy Lyons is going to be moving to Shamrock Rovers.
Yeah, so I think someone summed it up on Twitter that Andy Lyons doesn't like reggae music. So that's what here. So yeah, good news for Bohemians there. Have released their away jersey, which features an image of Bob Marley. Football fans will remember back in 2018, they also did this, but didn't have image rights from the Bob Marley family, so they had to pull the plug on that one. But they have linked up an agreement, and they'll be wearing that for the coming season. And important to note, 10% of the profits from the shirt sales will go to providing musical instruments for people in asylum centres around the country, which is obviously a great cause. And I suppose for Bohemian Football Club themselves, listen, it's a great way to embed themselves in the community in Dalymount Park. I think I'm right in saying that the last place where Bob Marley played his last ever outdoor concert, I think, back in 1980.
That's the story anyway.
Yeah, so yeah, no, listen, and you know, it's really good for Bohemian Football Club, as I say, embedding themselves in that community, similar to what Sligo are doing out west. I know Galway are kind of, all their social medias as well, get trying to attract the kind of Irish speaking community in the local area. Shells in the northeast of Dublin, and of course Pats in Inchicore as well, doing really great community work there as well. But yeah, on the negative side, Andy Lyons, who was linked with a move to England, is going to close rivals Shamrock Rovers. And a quote from Stephen Bradley, I suppose, has really caught the headlines for positive reasons if you're Shamrock Rovers fans, and you might be a bit put out if you're a Bohemian fan. But Stephen Bradley saying, when we had a conversation, it was pretty straightforward. Andy recognised that he wanted to be with a team that is winning and competing for things. It's a change to improve every aspect, and we obviously represented that chance and that opportunity for him. So Andy Lyons will be lining out for Shamrock Rovers.
Shot fired there, to be fair.
It is,
Stephen Bradley ahead of the new season.
Yeah, well, that's what you want. You want the League of Ireland to be a bit tasty in the off season. And also, just a small bit of transfer news, Aidan Keane going from Falkirk to Sligo Rovers, former Shell schoolboy and St Pat's player. So he's bounced around a lot, really, with a few loan spells, and he's only in his early 20s, so hopefully Liam Buckley gets the best out of him out west.
Well, there are lots of texts coming in with people, loads of people are out and about at games today. Great to, or over the weekend, great to see them all coming in. One texter has reminded me of St. Joseph's in Tulla, their Hearty Cup semi-final win over De La Salle and Waterford, and a historic first final appearance for Tulla, and they're getting great support from the East Clare hurling community as well. So that is brilliant to see. I'm very familiar with Tulla Secondary School, only up the road from me in Six Mile Bridge. Really good hurling tradition around there. But getting that result over the weekend will be a huge boost to everybody from around there. So fair play to them and best of luck to them in the Hearty final as well. Now, there was also rugby this weekend and plenty of it. So after this weekend's Champions Cup, all four Irish provinces now know who they will face in the last 16 of the Champions Cup after the pool stages reached their climax yesterday. So the most eye-catching of all the matchups is an all-Irish showdown between Leinster and Connacht. Connacht will have home advantage for that first leg on the weekend of the 8th to the 10th of April, and then travel to Dublin for the return game a week later. And it emerged this afternoon that the game could potentially be played at the Aviva Stadium. There are plans in motion to see if it can be moved, so we'll be following that. Ulster, after four wins from the four pool stage games, finished second in Pool A and can now look forward to a two-legged clash with Toulouse, who came seventh in Pool B. That seems a pretty unattractive prize, really, when you win four from four. And then Munster will also have the benefit of a second leg home conference when they square up to the Exeter Chiefs. So they had a really good win over Wasps on Sunday. Now, to go through all of the rugby action, I am delighted to say that Rory Best and Shane Byrne both join me on the line. Rory, to you first. Let's go with Ulster, because as I just mentioned there, look, they did have a really good pool stage performances in all of their games, but now they're going to have to come up against Toulouse, which is going to be a difficult prospect.
I think it is going to be exceptionally difficult for them. I think winning four from four and coming second in that group, you probably wanted somebody other than Toulouse. I do think that it's a really, really even competition, but like Leinster and Toulouse look like the two teams on paper that would be fairly strong favourites for it. So I think the other disadvantage that Ulster have is it's now, with it being over two legs, I think if it had been one game at the Kingspan Stadium, I think that the way Ulster are playing, you'd fancy them against anyone at home. But I think to try to do that over two legs is incredibly difficult for them.
Yeah, it's a tough one, all right. A hard one to stomach, as you said. Leinster there would probably be the only worse option, really, than getting Toulouse. And look, they, against Claremont Auvergne at the weekend, it was a good performance up to a point, but it was disappointing to see them, to let Claremont Auvergne back into it, Rory.
It was, and it's been a little bit like that with Ulster this season. You know, they race into a lead, and probably the last quarter of games they'll be disappointed with how they see games out. But I think the problem is with this really young backline is that they're learning, and they're also trying to figure out how to close games out. And they're going to have to be better. They're certainly going to have to be better in Toulouse over two legs, where every point counts. So they'll look back and they'll be disappointed, but I think from an Ulster point of view, when you look at the first 60 minutes, probably even nearly 65 minutes, they were really, really good. And Claremont really, even at half time, were holding on by a thread, really, to still be in that game. And it was encouraging to see how Ulster blew them away at the start of the second half, but a little bit frustrating to see how they sat back. They'd done the same the week before in Northampton, when Northampton got the ball back on 79 and a half minutes. Was still a chance to win a game that they never should have been anywhere near.
Shane Byrne is also with us. Shane, like what Rory says there, they had five tries in those first 65 minutes, but trying to get the balance of getting off to that explosive start and being able to continue it for over an hour, but just not been able to finish it out. You won't be able to do that. You won't be able to have that blip when you're coming up against Toulouse.
No, not in knockout stages traditionally. It was great to see that it wasn't just a back run game or forwards. It was right throughout. As you could see, the scoring, Perrin getting two pushovers and then the backs scoring the tries with Lowry. Again, amazing that right away for that 60-65 minutes, they were in complete control, as Rory said. But that is something that is going to be key, because it happens so often that their form dips towards the end of the game. that you'll know the teams were just targeted. Teams will aim to make sure that they're in touch in the scoreline just towards that end of the game, and then they'll ramp it up, and that has to stop. That Achilles heel that they seem to have that appears too often, they have to get rid of that.
Rory, can you coach that, or does it just take experience and learning from the knocks and learning those lessons?
I think they can be set up certainly to help them. I think that Ulster, when you look at the way they played this season, is that they try to play everything fast tempo. They go off the top of the line out, and if you take it sort of set pieces in the middle of the pitch, they go off the top of the lot and they play with this great tempo. They train with this great tempo, and for me, they've a really, really strong maul, and I would love to see them, especially in that last quarter. There's nothing wrong, and I'm not for negative rugby, but there's also nothing wrong with setting up a maul on the halfway line, getting a penalty, screwing it into the corner again, and almost wasting 5 minutes and strangling a team, which they don't seem to do or want to do.
Yeah, well, they'll have to get on with that pretty quickly, because those games will come around quicker than we know it, and that preparation will have to be done. And look, they're not the only team in that situation as well, Shane. If you look at Connacht and just the disappointment that they're going to be coming home with after going to France and not being able to get that win.
Well, that was absolutely such a frustrating game to watch. Again, they came out very much like Ulster, playing a fantastic brand of rugby, very much wanting to keep the ball in hand, all about attack. They were 11 points ahead at one point, and then they just, you could actually see them almost come take the foot off the gas. And Stad just started to realise that they had a chance, the momentum that they got going, and Connacht were dead in their feet. They literally couldn't stop them. And to have so many good results, to qualify again, to get a draw like that against Leinster, who we know are hitting incredible form at the moment, it's such a cruel draw.
Shane, how are they, or Rory, how are they when they're coming back from France? Like, can you take positives out of that game, or is it a case that you're going to have to try and pick yourself up and build confidence?
I think Shane's right. I think they'll look at the way they're playing, and they're playing some fantastic rugby, and they're going to have to work out the same as Ulster how to navigate that last quarter. And it was interesting hearing Jack Cardy after the game, you know, taking a little bit of responsibility on himself, and that's how they'll get better. You know, he learned from that, and if he wants to be pushing on to be an international 10, you know, those are the sort of games that, especially that Leicester game at home, you know, to give them the chances they did. Away from home can be a wee bit different, because when momentum turns away from home, sometimes you can feel it's on top of you. But look, I think they'll take a lot of positives from the way they're playing, and they're going to have to learn how to see games out, and that it's not always about the same as other things. They're very, very similar.
Yeah, there's probably a market there for someone who has pinpointed a way to do that, all right, because it is seem like it's a common problem for those two provinces at the moment. It's certainly not a problem for Leinster, though, Shane. Another hugely impressive performance this weekend. I don't even know where to start. Tell us about Jimmy O'Brien, though. 4 tries.
Wow.
And not a household name. Not yet, anyway.
Yeah, incredible. One of the absolute conveyor belts of players that Leinster just produced, that Leo Cullen just manages such a huge squad. To produce a guy like this, as you say, like, he's been around, he's got plenty of caps. That's the way Leo runs that team, that you're never a rabbit in the headlights, you've always had experience. But absolutely exploding on the scene. And in the European Cup, okay, look, I know Bath are down at the bottom of the Gallagher Premiership, you can only play against UR, but everything he did was absolutely 100% execution was perfect, and even down to a try saving tackle as well, really putting the body on the line. Everything he did was superb. But then again, that whole game, just as Rory said at the very start, they look to be one of the teams that have to be taken note. Everything they did was clinical. They weathered the storm at the start of the game. Bath had the majority of the ball, very, very patient, and then every opportunity they had, they took. And Johnny Sexton just completely controlling the game. Van der Fleer, Larmer, all these guys having massive, massive impacts, but all about the go forward. Very impressive.
Rory, tell us honestly now. You're sitting there watching Johnny Sexton. Did you think that he would be this sharp and this effective at this stage of his career?
a thing with Johnny is that because it's not all about athletic ability with him, he has plenty of it, but it's because he's smart, he's always a step, at least a step ahead of everyone else. And as long as that sort of warmth and that mental sharpness and the body held up, you knew that he was always going to play really well. And I think the interesting thing about Leinster, and Shane said it there, it's how they weathered the storm at the start. And that's something that the Ulster and the Connacht can look at, to go that Leinster, they have an ability to weather a storm, and they understand how to turn that momentum. They understand how to get field position. And a lot of that is Johnny. He knows when to kick, he knows when to manipulate a kick to make that kick attacking, and just to get a team and understand that his Leinster team, they needed to get the ball, but they also needed to get out of their own half, and he did that. And that he's just, the way he's playing, even coming back from that break that he had with the injury, to come back in and just pick it up the way he always has, it's a testament to the work that he does. But it's not just about the physical work with him, it's about how much he watches and studies the opposition and understands how Leinster are playing, and a lot of how Leinster are playing is his vision on rugby, and it really helps when you have a general like that.
Shane, I'd say there's a lot of people, probably Johnny himself included, watching Tom Brady over the weekend as well at 44 and he's probably going, and other people as well are going, there's a good few years left in
him. Yeah, is it possible? Is there a chance? Yeah, he really is the mercurial player. He is, I think Rory said it best though, it's so much more to him than just athletic ability or anything like that. It's the mind and the experience he has. Like even when we saw it, something simple as you know, looking across, that he took the ball and he looked across for Tommy's, I think it was his third try, the cross kick off the penalty. You know, just to be aware all the time of every opportunity. If there's a space to inflict pain on the opposition, he's the right man to do it, and he keeps that scoreboard moving, you know, all the time for Leinster, and is pulling the strings of a team that are really, really firing fantastically at the moment.
Yeah, it's brilliant to watch him now, to be fair, and just to see him just getting the absolute best out of himself, and knowing as well that, you know, he probably does have a good bit left in him in yet, just the way he seems to be able to operate at that level faultlessly for most of the time as well. Rory, what about Munster? Just watching them, it seemed like a really encouraging performance. They were much more open and expansive, their execution was better, and it felt like from just even their own confidence and self-belief, given the fact that there was a big crowd there, that this was an important win for them over Wasps.
Yeah, it was, and I think you go, when you're playing a team, you're already qualified, and you're playing a team that are desperate to get anything to get them into the knockout stages. You know, there can sometimes be a difficult game, especially with Wasps starting strongly, but they just hit the same, they weathered the storm, and then they played, did some fantastic tries in the middle of that, and they certainly look like a team that you wouldn't particularly want to play in knockout rugby. You saw how they dug so deep last week to get the win away in Doncaster, and then this week was a lot more about getting the ball and playing rugby and getting some of these really brilliant players they have on the ball. I think the way that up front, you see the way Tadhg Byrne and Pete O'Mahony, who are, you know, you look for figureheads within teams, and how they play can sometimes dictate how a team goes, and those two in particular are going incredibly well, and they're sort of driving that Munster pack forward. And then look at halfbacks, and Conor Murray is back, and he's given whichever of the young out halves they play so much time in the ball, which is helping.
It feels, Shane, that we did get glimpses. We got to see what they're capable of and the potential that this team have as well.
If this was a Munster side that would be back in the days when they were regularly winning silverware, what Rory said would have been exactly right. This is a team that is just coming in form, just in time for the knockout stages. They really were. You don't know how they've been during the season. You're nervous watching them. You just don't know what way they're going to play. That was like a breath of fresh air at the weekend. They played superbly. You know, obviously, Zeebo coming in, there was loads of headline grabbers, becoming the top try scorer. Gavin Combs, Jack O'Donoghue were excellent. But it was young Ben Healy, to me, really steered the ship. We were talking about Johnny Sexton pulling the strings with Leinster. He was absolutely superb right the way throughout the game. And if this is something that Munster can continue on into the knockout stages, it's going to be so important, because that was a superb performance right the way across. As was said, Wasps wanted to get a minimum of a losing bonus point, and they just were never allowed into this game.
Yeah, it seems like there's plenty to build on there. Anyway, Rory and Shane, thank you so much for joining us this evening. We're going to take a very quick break now, and then we're back with Premier League.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Your rise and grind isn't real. Our protein is Get Real.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. I'm Marie Crowe, and I'm delighted to be joined in studio by Shane Dawson of RTÉ Sports, and also Alan Corley, former professional footballer. Stephen Kelly joins us on the line. Also, we are going to talk Premier League now. And Alan, we better start with Ranieri, because it's just been announced and confirmed already that he is no longer going to be the Watford boss. It feels like only yesterday we were celebrating his arrival and remembering his time with Leicester, but he's gone now as quick as he's arrived.
Yeah, I'm not surprised, Marie. I'm surprised he's actually lasted this long, but you look at the performance the other night, and it's the second week in a row really that Norwich have beaten a team and then their manager gets sacked following that defeat, and you look at where Norwich are in the table fighting for their lives. And but I actually fancied them because they beat Everton last week, so they're on a bit of a high. I think Dean Smith has done quite well since he's gone in, but for whatever reason with Ranieri, it just hasn't happened, hasn't worked at all. You look at the amount of defeats they've had on a horrendous run, Marie, and it doesn't surprise me in the slightest. And I was watching the game the other night, and I was trying to decide who would I prefer to see win and maybe stay up. And I have a little bit of a grow for Norwich because of obviously the young Irish lads, and we want to see them do well. And I'm glad that they've turned their fortunes around. And I like Dean Smith as well. Whereas I thought then about my feelings towards Watford, and there's zero feelings towards Watford, Marie. I just can't in any way find some sort of and even a minimal association that I might like or might want to see them do well. And the only link I probably do like about Watford is the Elton John link, because Elton John was a bit of a superstar, but apart from that, the football side of things, I have no time really for them in terms of what they bring to the league, what they're offering, the kind of yo-yo up and down, going nowhere really, and I'm not surprised to see Ranieri leave.
Stephen Kelly is with us as well. So Stephen, Allen has a zero feelings for Watford, but what do you think went wrong in that situation? Like, just given the fact that you've been at clubs before when managers came and went, was it just that he couldn't connect with the players, couldn't get the best out of them, just didn't have good enough players?
A bit of everything, and it's also the Watford way. I probably have a little bit more sentiment. I actually play for Watford for a bit, so maybe a little bit closer.
I had to know that, Stephen. Yeah, you know, I've been all over.
But thankfully, there's a bit of impartiality now.
So, what are the level of your feelings then for Watford?
No, I think it's very hard to connect with Watford with the way that they do business, and I think that's why they don't have, you know, teams in the league, they play good football. Like Norwich will have a sprinkling of fans that support their other sides, and they might be their second team or a team that they'd be like happy for them to stay up, whereas Watford just are not going to get that from people because the way the board conduct themselves and how often they sack managers. You know, Ranieri wasn't working, but you know, times before, and you think of Pearson and all these crazy things that they've done, and Sanchez and Flores, it's a roller coaster, and it's just managers in and out the door all the time, so it's very hard to connect with them. And Alan's right, you know, I'd rather see Norwich stay up because Dean Smith is a likeable character. You feel a bit of hard done by at Villa because he did really well for them, and you know, I think Watford, it's just they want another bounce, they want to bring a manager in to get a bounce, a few games, results on the spin of a new manager, and hopefully see them raise up the table, and then maybe change them again before the end of the season.
That's it. There's still a bit of football to be played yet. Anything could happen there. Shane, before we move on to the weekend's action, you have a little bit of breaking AFCON news for me?
Yeah, I'm loving the AFCON news.
I was going to say, you're all over the AFCON, Shane, aren't you?
I'm the official RTÉ correspondent for AFCON now. I'm calling it now. So we were mentioning earlier, obviously, Comoros have to plan without their three goalkeepers. It was a bit of uproar earlier today, considering one did return a negative COVID test, but due to Confederation rules, he won't be able to play. So Comoros have named their left full, Shakir El Hadour, in goal for tonight's match. So everyone who says Ashranium can play in goal, it's an easy role. We'll see how easy it is.
They
now
didn't give any further information about why they picked him. Like, is he good at kickouts, a shot stopper, does he ever go in there?
No, I was trying to think back as well about kind of players playing in goal, and obviously Niall Quinn, John O'Shea, and I suppose you could throw Ashton or Irish to have that GAA background. I'm not sure if a player who's applying his trade in the French divisions has any GAA background or any goalkeeping experience, so nothing on that yet. But as I say, it is a breaking story and a developing story, so if I hear anything before 7 o'clock, Marie, I'll be straight in.
Please do stay on that. Alan, let's look at Chelsea and Spurs, and look, it feels like a really big win for Chelsea just given their form going into one win in seven. They needed it.
Yeah, absolutely, Marie. And I think this is showing more so, obviously, as you say, Chelsea needed the win and needed the victory, but it was comfortable, so comfortable. And I think what it highlights, and to be fair to Conte, he came out afterwards and said it, probably aiming a little bit of a dig at Levy, but I'm sure Levy is fully aware in terms of what Conte wants to bring in kind of new recruits as such. But I think what it did highlight, and not only this game, but you look at the two Carabao Cup semi-finals as well, Spurs never laid a glove on them, really, Marie, over the three games. And when you're getting beaten as comprehensively as that against one of your near rivals, now not rivals in terms of winning a league, but rivals, obviously London rivals, and Spurs do see themselves as obviously a very big club and they're aspiring to one day maybe get to that top four, eventually win a league, possibly. How far that's off, I'm not so sure. It's very far off at the moment, but when you're getting beaten as comprehensively as that, that's exactly what it highlights for me. And I think Conte will be banging on the door if he's not been banging on the door already, because there's players there that are just nowhere near the level, if they have aspirations to obviously break into the top four. And they're in a good position in the sense that they're battling out with Arsenal and United and West Ham to get into that top four. And I think if he was to get one or two in, they have a really good chance. Added to the fact that he's a brilliant manager. And I think that's been highlighted already, Marie, in the sense that you look at the job that he's done since he's come in, with a limited group, and a group who look a little bit of a mishmash in terms of their attitude as well. I'm not so sure about a couple of the characters in there as well. So I think he's done a great job, but I think what that game and obviously the two semi-finals have highlighted is just how far Spurs are off the top teams.
Yeah, Alan's right there, Stephen. You could just, listening to Conte in his post-match, you could tell how disappointed he was, and it was frustration as well, because he knew, and he said it himself, it's just a different level, really.
The gulf in class is huge, and you know Tottenham are it's hard because Tottenham are nowhere near, but every team in the league is nowhere near City, Liverpool or Chelsea. Spending powers, and you kind of take United up there with that, but the squad they have, you know, Kovacic came off and they put in N'Golo Kante, and you're looking going like, that's ridiculous, like it's just it's not, almost not fair. But I think what was screaming out for me was that Conte actually changed his system. So they've been beat comfortably by them twice in the Carabao Cup over the last few weeks, and then he changed to a 4-4-2, which I'm not too sure I've ever seen him do as a manager in his whole career. And he actually just did it, put fullbacks, like Doherty was playing right wing in front of Tanganga, and then you had Sessegnon playing left wing in front of Ben Davies. So he literally just tried to go out there and not lose the game, and it still wasn't enough. And then you take Son into the equation, him not being there is massive. But I think my worry as ex-Spurs and a Spurs fan is that you're worried that he's just going to go. I think we're going to break Conte. I think we're going to break him as a club, and we're going to have him here for 18 months, and I just can't see him staying any longer than that, because I just don't think he's going to have the resources.
Yeah, he just looked really sad, I thought, in the post.
And he's a brilliant manager, Marie. He's so good, Conte. He's absolutely brilliant. As I said, we've seen that with him since he's come in. It's funny, Stephen alluded to the fact that it's the first time it's actually the first time he's gone to a 4-4-2 since the very first time he played with three at the back. I think with Chelsea, there were three down, changed the formation at half time, and he's played 3-5-2 ever since. Changed the formation yesterday to no avail, really. As I say, they were well beaten, but I'm with Stephen on that. That would be the worry for Spurs. If I was a Spurs fan and Daniel Levy is not prepared to back him, when you think how good he is, where do you go from there?
Stephen, what about Manchester City? Do we have a title race now? They show that they're human. Their 12-game Premier League run came to an end, and they were held to a 1-1 draw by Southampton. I couldn't have predicted that.
Oh, absolutely not. Maybe Pep jinxing a team that Ward-Prowse is the best free kick taker in the world. But I don't know. It's just I think they're not going to drop many points. I mean, we've spoken about this before, and we always thought Chelsea would be the ones that would be really pushing, and Liverpool. But you think that Liverpool, to get the result they did, and to be, you know, there's a glimmer of hope that City might mess up. But when you look at the fixtures, they've got game in hand, and then they have to play City at the Etihad. So you kind of think, you know, that actually makes it really interesting, and it's going to pull a bit more pressure on them. And whether they feel pressure or they're just robots, I don't know, but you know, they're capable of drawing blood, which Southampton did, and it was nice to see that, you know, they're not invincible, but they're still a sublime side, and you can't see them doing that very often.
But Alan, Southampton have shown though that they know how to frustrate them. Mm. And when you look at what they're doing, just they stay focused on the task, and they pack the middle of the park as much as possible. Like, have they found that blueprint to potentially cause trouble for City and for other people to look at?
Yeah, it's almost a Hasenhüttl template, isn't it, to how to get points off Man City, because as you said, away from home and obviously at home as well, and they have done quite well. I want to praise Southampton, Marie, right, but I have to be critical as well. And the goal that they conceded, honestly, Hasenhüttl, they've done so much work. Every one of the players put in an unbelievable shift, and I thought there was a brilliant description after the match, Walker Peters, when he was asked in the interview after the game about playing against Man City and that the quality that they possess, he described it as almost a brain game, he called it. It was a brilliant description, because when you're playing against superior opposition, and mentally, not only physically, but mentally, you have to be so in tune with what's happening, especially with Man City, with the players that they have and the fluency of their movement, and there's players running here, there and everywhere, and you switch off for a second, and that's what does you, Marie. So it was a brilliant description for him. But where they got done was a set piece. And that's the easiest thing to organise. If you get carved open in football by superior opposition or better players, which Man City will have, sometimes you just have to hold your hand up and say, look, that was a pure moment of magic, a piece of quality from De Bruyne, whatever the case may be. But to lose a goal on a set piece, and so poorly as well, because if you look at the two centre-halves, Salihu, and it was Lianku who came on as a sub, the two of them are basically marking space, the centre of the goal. But the three biggest threats that Man City have in Laporte and the other centre-half that was it Diaz that was there as well, they're at the back post, right? I took free kicks all my life, Marie. It's not a difficult free kick to clip a ball over two centre-halves who are in the middle of the pitch and flick it onto someone's head. And that's exactly what De Bruyne did, who's an unbelievable set-piece delivery. So as much as I want to praise them, and they did great to get the result, Hasenhüttl, he'd be absolutely fuming with the goal that they conceded. It was dreadful.
It was only a moment though, and like as you said, you have to praise them because they did manage to have that concentration for so long. Whereas if you just even compare them to Liverpool, so Liverpool put together this unbelievable first half of football, Stephen, against Crystal Palace, and then they just switched off, not just for a moment, for pretty much for a lot of the second half. They just didn't seem to be with it that much.
Oh, it was like, you talk about chalk and cheese. Like, it was a completely different side that almost turned up. And Klopp alluded to it, like, is that is afterwards. And you have to go, love how refreshing it can be at times. He was just like, it was just different game. Like, Jekyll and Hyde, they just didn't turn up the second half. It's almost like they thought they'd won it. But Palace were excellent, and they had so many good chances. And then you go to the penalty, and you're looking, going, like, how that was given is beyond me. And Liverpool were very lucky, because that swung the game then in their favour. It gave them that little bit of momentum to see it through, and just killed Palace in the same instance. But you got to give credit to Palace, because they looked dangerous, they looked quick, and Liverpool at times just couldn't deal with their pace and their strength. And Alisson pulled off a really good save, the lob over his head, just got back, worked his feet and pulled it off. But you know, I think the only thing is that it puts Liverpool in it, and seeing City drop points, which you don't expect then to go on and get a win like that, those wins feel, you know, when you don't play that well and you almost feel like you don't deserve it, they're almost there's more joy in them for some reason, just because you feel like you got away with one.
It was interesting, Alan, listening to, I don't know if anyone saw Sky Sports News this morning, the football show, and they were talking about Alisson and the performance that he had and how much he was determined to do well, and just that competitiveness that you could see in him. And look, he was really, really good. But they were crediting Caoimhín Kelleher for that, because they were saying, because Kelleher is now a genuine contender for the number one spot, that he has to up his game, like he did it, but still, those performances by Kelleher of late are making Alisson work harder.
It's a brilliant point, Marie, because when I was watching the game and the saves that he was pulling off, there was one in the first half as well. Now, it was offside. He still had to save it. It was incredible. And the one Stephen alluded to from Alisson, the little lob in the second half, absolutely brilliant as well. But it's a great point, because the debate around Kelleher at the start of the season was, he's only young, he's developing, he's happy to be, not that he's happy to be there, he's at a great club, he's developing, the understudy to a brilliant goalkeeper, and let it just play out naturally. He'll get the odd game here and there. Then he comes in, and he's been as good as he has, and then the debate turns to, oh, he's so good, he needs to go out and loan, he needs to play. I'm actually gone to the third scenario, Marie, where I'm actually saying he's putting pressure on Alisson now. And as you say, Alisson now is looking at him as a serious contender, serious competition, and I need to up my game as well. And that's exactly what he did. And it's brilliant for Alisson as well, because it keeps him on his toes also. And it just tells you how good Kelleher is, because Alisson is world class. He's absolutely brilliant. It tells you how good Kelleher is, that this is the level that he's getting to and that he's competing with. It's absolutely outstanding. I have to mention the penalty though, Marie. It was an absolute disgrace. And some of the free kicks and the decisions or penalties over the weekend, some of them were absolutely dreadful. And that one, as Stephen said, where Crystal Palace then obviously were out of the game, because Crystal Palace are really good. I love watching them. Vieira's done a great job. But Liverpool did get lucky. But Liverpool, to be fair, are doing brilliant, Marie, because when you don't have Salah and Mane, they're still winning, they're still hot in the tails of City, and I don't think the race is over.
Okay, just before we finish up, okay, so we're giving credit to Southampton, we're giving credit to Crystal Palace. Are we giving any credit to Manchester United, Stephen?
Not giving credit to Southampton.
No, that's just a brush past them. Ruby's not here, so we don't have to give them any credit whatsoever. No, I don't. Rashford, they're actually kind of lucky, because VAR that could have been ruled off as well. But Cavani, we've seen them go for like a fingernail or something stupid like that. But they got the win, they got over the line. They've been okay. They're just a bit meh at the moment, and that's United. And they're so far off the other three in consistency levels and everything else. But they got the win, they got over the line against a resilient, tough West Ham. West Ham and Moyes, he sets his team there really well. They're organised, the work rate, the energy. The camaraderie in that team is amazing to see, and they have a real threat as well going forward. So it's big points for United to get on the board, because that wasn't an easy game for them.
Alan, is it just the case now where people have to accept that these are the performances that are going to come under Rangnick?
I watched the game. I actually thought they were a little bit better. I'm going to give them credit for the first time all year, Marie. And when I say that, it's probably due to the fact that West Ham, I think, are a really good side as well. And for the first time, I looked at a Man U performance and thought, they're very competitive, they were very physical, they looked like they were actually at it for the first time, whereas I looked at them in so many weeks where you're questioning their attitude, you're questioning everything about them, whereas they were actually looked like the bare minimum is that they were up for it, which is a terrible thing to say when you think professional footballers, that should be a given. But we haven't seen that, whereas I saw it at the weekend, West Ham were good, it was nip and tuck, there wasn't much in the game at all. And psychologically, what that goal will do for them going forward, you just can't put a price on that, Marie, because it's unbelievable. It was like the old days with Fergie time. You score a goal like that, the crowd go mad. We haven't seen those scenes in a long time. So I think it'll give them huge confidence going forward. It was a massive result, and I have to pick out Declan Rice. Was absolutely unbelievable, and if Man United are not looking to sign him now, they'll never look to sign him. He's unbelievable.
The one issue I just wanted to follow up there with Alan as well, I was watching this match with a diehard Man United fan, and she jumped up to celebrate and then had to stop because you were thinking about VAR and if it's going to be ruled out, like Stephen mentioned. Well, and it's
initially
just,
I thought it was off.
Yeah, but it's so frustrating. You can't celebrate goals anymore. Yeah. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
It's tough. Okay, guys. Well, we are going to take a very quick break. Stephen and Alan, thank you so much. Shane, you are still on AFCON duty, so don't go anywhere. And we'll be back shortly talking NFL.
Game on 2FM. With Green Farm. Rise and grind and the hustle mindset aren't real. The protein in our chicken is. Get real.
The man open left.
Game on. I in America.
Now, I am delighted to say that we are joined on the line by Jeff Shepherd to reflect on all of the weekend's NFL action. And wow, Shep, it was dramatic. It actually doesn't get more dramatic than what happened at the weekend.
No, absolutely not, Marie. And look, you know, we live in a world now where we want to judge everything that happens as like the greatest in the history of everything. I don't know if this is the greatest weekend of NFL playoff football, but I don't know another time where we've had four games that were decided all on the last play of the game or in overtime. Just incredible drama all weekend long.
So let's just go with that it's been the greatest you've seen since you started chatting to me on Game On, and I think that would be pretty fair.
I think that would be fair, 100%.
So for you, look, was it the Bills and the Kansas City Chiefs that really got you going?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, again, same thing. I mean, this feels like it was, you know, a top five football game that we've ever seen, and really the quarterbacks were just stupendous. I mean, Patrick Mahomes, obviously, we all know so much about him and how great he is. But Josh Allen really just turned it on last night, and it's so unfair. You know, the big discussion today is what happens with the NFL and the overtime rules. But, I mean, you know, it was a pretty close game for most of the way, and then in the final 2 minutes, I don't even know how to try to describe it. I mean, the Chiefs scored, and they left too much time for Josh Allen, who scored and left too much time for Patrick Mahomes. And then they went to overtime. I mean, it was just a spectacular football game. And the Chiefs get a touchdown pass from Mahomes to Kelce to advance to the AFC Championship game. And it really, it's just kind of hard to describe the night. It had the game of the year written all over it. And I mentioned that Friday in our preview. And it 100% lived up to the hype. You know, it doesn't always do that. And that was certainly the case here last night, though.
Yeah, definitely. And as you said, it's rare that the games that are billed to be amazing actually are amazing. So when they deliver, you just got to savor every single bit of them. What about the Rams and the Bucks, though? Tom Brady almost got another fairy tale.
So look, let's make no mistake here. This was not a good football game. This was just a really good final 15 minutes because the Rams were basically trying not to throw up all over themselves, and they were failing. And then you have Tom Brady trying to come back from a 27-3 deficit, which sounds a whole lot like trying to come back from a 28-3 deficit, right? You know, which they did a couple of years ago when he was with New England in the Super Bowl against Atlanta. They were able to pull even late in the game, but Matthew Stafford connects with Cooper Kupp, who is somehow left open on two consecutive plays. I don't know how you leave the best wide receiver in football open, but they sure enough did, and the Rams kicked the game-winning field goal on the last play of the game to hold on, and they will now host the NFC Championship game next weekend.
Okay, so Shep, we are out of time, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a little bit more time for yourself to let all of the weekend's action soak in, and I will check in with you again on Thursday, and we will also look ahead to more weekend action as well. So thank you very much, Shep.
Appreciate it.
Right, we will be chatting to Shep on our usual Thursday slot. That is all we have time for this evening. Shane, thank you so much for coming into studio. Ronan, Laura Lee, to you guys as well. We'll be back tomorrow. We will have Rob Cornwell in with us to look back at his career and where he is heading to next. Plenty to go through, and Shane will have an AFCON update for us as well. As always, as expected, Tara Kumar is up next.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Being flat to the mat isn't real. Our protein is. Get real.